lectures throughout this week have gone for the full hour, and they haven't really allowed an opportunity for discussion afterward. And perhaps sometimes when you tell stories anyway, it's a little bit difficult to go from that kind of listening mode to discussionary mode. Then Larry suggested, and I thought it was a good idea, and Dan too, that what we do is set aside time specifically for discussion. When we're not chasing up a story afterward, or we're not leading to one, or whatever. So what this will be is totally open to any kind of discussion or thought that may be on your mind, back and forth between me and you, or even among yourselves. It seems to me that there are several areas that you could think at least about talking about. One is the storying of Scripture itself, and anything you would like to dig into with that. The other may be some of the specific stories that were offered during this last week, and we touched three forms, if you remember: myth, epic, and history itself, history retold. I used the word several times this morning, legend, which doesn't make it the untrue history, but it says the interpreted history. So any kind of thoughts that may have arisen during the week are certainly fodder for discussion. Anything else? Yes?
It was on when you were talking about epic and how, if I remember rightly, when you mentioned Roots coming very close to being an epic and how everyone was searching for their identity. And I wondered if you were speaking more of Western civilization, America in particular, that we don't often most of us don't have connections. And if you, I sort of felt that you were speaking also of the world in the 20th century. Like, you know, do you make a distinction there? I mean, because I think we must be a special people, those of us that are colonials of any sort.
Yeah? Right.
You know, and that we've lost touch with our original myths. Yeah?
Yes.
I just wonder if you want to elaborate on that.
Okay, I think that you're already beginning to answer it properly. I will speak from my very narrow experience, which is all within this country. But even as I listen to John DeGruchy talk, and he's able to say where his wife's parents came from, what did he say? That they were Cornish, he used.
Yeah.
That's really specific. To a guy like, I know that my parents are German heritage, and if I looked at a map, I could finally put my finger, but I have no sense of what was going on in that area that they came from. So I guess I'm speaking mostly of, as you said, this colonial culture, this culture where we were uprooted, black and white together, and maybe even more black than the white, although white just dismissed a lot of their heritage. I don't know about other civilizations. Here is John knowing a little bit more specifically. I don't know how it is in South Africa. I suspect that others around here know better than that. But generally, yes.
What I think is interesting is when you're in this country, you ask somebody what they are, and they'll say, I'm Norwegian or Finnish or German. And then you're over in Europe, and immediately when someone will say, what are you, your instinct is to say German, Norwegian, because we always think of our own ethnic heritage. And then you have to immediately think, no, I'm an American. But over there, they would immediately just say what country they're from, and that's their ethnic identity and their
right.
Cultural
and that's an entire bag full. Ours is a bag filling. And we're not sure. Some of the stuff is good, and some of the stuff makes us terribly uncomfortable. And it only goes back so and so many generations. And we are hungry, I think, for those roots. Yeah. Yes. Oh, speak up.
Well, you may not like this because I'm going to get back at you. Because today, this morning, you were talking about your little boy.
Yes.
And we were talking about heritage and how you probably got what you were doing to your little boy from your heritage. Well, I'm a very sentimental person, and so while you were talking about this, I felt the corners of my eyes kind of getting wet, but you kind of broke up my macho image. But I want to tell you about this. When I was a little boy, I'm also of German extraction, and my father had one way of raising boys, and that was you had a total line. And again, he got that from his heritage. And he would very often, if we were going off the line, he would paddle us and we would know just exactly where to go. See, we never had the problem that young people have today as to what was right and what was wrong. We always knew what was wrong. That came real easy. But we always loved my father. We always loved my father. We never hated him. And so I just want to say this, that from what you tell me, this little happening, I think you're a pretty nice daddy. Now you get tears near us.
You know, one thing that Phil is about to ask, look like your knit brow is going to say something, but I would like to throw something to all of you. Several times throughout this week, people have asked about storytelling, and I think they have kind of singled out what these lectures... Oh, no! Did that hurt?
No. I would say
can't. Singled out these lectures as being in some way or other unique. I very seriously want to tell all of you that storytelling is not a unique thing. What I think makes storytelling unique today is that we have almost willingly given up the practice. But all these stories that were told today have been told countless times before. They were passed on orally. It's only, I think, in the last generations that oral storytelling has kind of fallen into disuse because of radio and television. I often think when I hear the elderly want to tell the young people of the life that they lived years ago, that what is happening is the blessing. I have 2 points here I'll juggle for just a little minute. It's the blessing that took place in Genesis chapter 49, where Jacob called all of his sons together and he said, "Now, let me tell you what's going to happen to you." But he told them what was going to happen to them by what had been the past, what they had done in the past, what Reuven or Reuben had done in the past, gave Jacob a perception of what the future would be. So that when this elderly parent gathered children together and spoke of the past, in the past also was the present identified, and was the future made possible. That was a blessing. It's the same sort of thing as we saw when other parents, such as Isaac, took Jacob and Esau and gave them blessings. Well, I watch the elderly, today still, swim upstream so hard. There's something in them that makes them want to tell stories. You can't remember yesterday too well. Don't know where left the plate or that sweater. I don't know what I did with that sweater. But you asked me about 1932. And I remember 1932 day by day, minute by minute, and I can give you the feelings and everything else like that. And what I am telling about is you should see when Papa and I, and Papa and I is grandfather and grandmother to these children where I want to tell these stories. It's a compulsion. There's a want to tell stories. And I think what's happening is it is the community wanting to pass the past on so that the present might be understood and so that the future might be perceived. If we know who we have been, we might begin to have some sense of who we shall be. It's blessing, it's scriptural. Now, that's a single example of the yearnings that I see always around me. I say the elderly swim upstream because where are these grandchildren? Zonked in front of a television set, because that's so much easier. It doesn't take the labor of listening and imagining and hearing that human voice weave the story like a tapestry into their souls. The television doesn't have to go into their souls. The television can go right through their minds. So they're swimming upstream against that and against a lot of other things. I listen to you talk. You listen to yourselves when you leave here and you have this afternoon or you sit down to table. I would guess, this is a sheer guess, but because I'm sitting here, people can take percentage guesses, that 80% of your conversation is story. Listen to yourself. What do you do when you're talking? You talk about, well, in the army, we this, such, and so. What is it in the army? You direct?
Oh, yeah. Play?
Yeah. Well, I'll bet some of those stories may have come down. Or even this morning, Fan and I were talking, and she was telling me of some of the things that had happened with the kids this morning. That story. So my major point that I finally want to come to is, I think that the human being is shaped to story to one another. And that's some of the best vessels of our communication across time and among people, person to person, generation to generation. And that we've simplified. Instead of letting the jongleurs, the old storytellers, the myth makers come and sit and do it for us, or we do it for them, we click them on television. Now.
Well,
yeah.
We've been doing something I think maybe other people might be interested in. The elderly people in our family, we are taping their stories. Yeah. And you sit down, and if they don't realize there's a tape around, they'll just talk and talk and talk. And the kids may not be right there right then, but later on,
they'll have it.
Oh, I hear this.
That's right.
And I just think it's a great way to do it if anybody's interested.
It's very much like Epic, isn't it? Because when the elderly talk and tell their stories, you find out how they made a saw way back then, or what they did to make a maple tree drip its sugar, or what they, you know, and they may not even be recognizing that they're giving you a recipe for maple syrup, but that's a part of the story itself. It's compendious. If we would only listen and be blessed, that's a part of that is my sadness, that the skill is still here, wanting to be done. Bill?
Much of my ministry the last several years has been involved in family therapy, and as I work with especially teenagers, I think one of the things that is most noticeably missing in terms of working within the family structure with teenagers is the fact that they want to hear story, but the family has effectively said, I don't want to expose myself as adult. And in the process of doing that, they say to the kids, don't listen to story. Because if you listen to story, you start exposing yourself. And when you start exposing yourself, you start talking about hurts and pains and weaknesses. And you've got to maintain the macho image. And you've got to maintain your individual identity. And boy, a lot of the kids that you talk to, that you relate to in therapy, are hurting because of the lack of being allowed to be human, be real.
And that doesn't mean just listening, that means telling a story, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That we're fearful of telling. Telling a story is very much like hugging. In order to hug someone else, you have to make yourself vulnerable.
Yeah.
You're wide open to a kick.
You start talking with kids and if you can really relate to them, within a matter of two or three sessions, all you need to do is hug.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just grab hold and hug, and that's the most effective communication.
And story is a complicated kind of hugging. It really is. I think you're on the money. We are afraid of a vulnerability. So what kind of story do we have in our heritage? Tall tales. Over-exaggerated kind of things. Stories on somebody else. On another race, like I told you, Indiana, they tell stories on Kentucky. Kentucky tells them on the Hoosiers and so forth. But that's the beginning of story, and that's honing the craft. If finally that craft can contain also an extraordinary I love you at the same time.
Part of that business, I think, about not wanting to expose yourself comes from an idea somewhere that we have to be self-sufficient and put ourselves on a pedestal and be real good, not make mistakes. And we don't have to be that way because we're loved and we're forgiven. And it's really, for me, hard to keep remembering that I'm forgiven because I've really done some screwy things. And yet if I can remember that, that I am loved and God does love me and he sent his son for me, it's easy. But that's really hard to do.
It's good that we use both theology together and the faith together with the practice. I know you're not all parents or grandparents. But while I have the opportunity, I seriously would, I think we may talk about this next week sometime, you may not all be here. I seriously would urge you, while the children are young, to tell them stories. Read, that's good, do, read to them, read. That's the stories of the culture talking. But tell them stories. You mentioned one reason why we don't, and that's because we don't like to be vulnerable. The other reason is we're afraid they're not going to be interested. I promise you, that's why I started by telling you about my father. it doesn't matter what a rotten storyteller you are. You sit down and you stumble through something. What's happening? What's happening is you're giving the relationship a framework in which it may be. I will suggest a book to you, those of you who are leaving, because I'm going to refer to it next week. It's Bruno Bettelheim's The Uses of Enchantment. Bruno Bettelheim takes Grimm's fairy tales and other fairy tales of other nations, but particularly the Grimm fairy tale. He's a psychologist. He's a psychologist who has done a great deal of studying also with children. And he suggests, A, that children work out, first of all, children discover their troubles in imagination. The troubles of the world around them, they translate until those troubles dwell within their imagination. It is in their imagination that they begin to work those troubles out again or to come to some kind of solution regarding the troubles. For those of you who will hear this also next week, forgive me, but I'll go a little bit farther into it. For example, a parent puts a child to bed at night and everything is gentle and sweet. If the parent is the mother, the child says, my princess. This is my princess, my mother, coming. And the mother kisses the child, and everything smells good and feels good. And then the cover is brought up, all those physical things underneath the chin, and the child goes to sleep. Next morning, the child gets up and goes downstairs looking for the princess. When the child gets downstairs and walks into the kitchen, the princess is at the sink, trying very hard to get things done quickly. And it works the same way with the father. At night, it's the prince, right? Gets downstairs, and it may be, as in our case, sometimes the father at the sink. And now here comes the child expecting the same kind of sweet relationship of loving and kissing and holding, and walks up and pulls on the, let's say, the skirt of the princess and says, "Hello, Mama Princess." And she says, "Get out of here! Don't you know that it's this part of the school? And if you don't move, I'm going to whoop your little buttons over there." Not a kid has a problem. Because on the one hand, this was an idealized princess, which is very important to have while you're growing up. Somebody trustworthy and kind. But on the other hand, it's also a witch. And Bruno Bettelheim, I'm not kidding now, suddenly in imagination, that's what the child does. Says, "Just have you seen Sleeping Beauty? No, not Sleeping. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Snow White is born with a sweet and beautiful mother who pricks her finger and the blood drops into the snow, and you have that extraordinary image of the red blood on the white snow, which gives her name. But that woman dies, and now comes the stepmother. Now what Bettelheim says is, the child has a problem with the two faces of the parent and really doesn't know how to work it out, except that in imagination the child begins to work it out and says, well, in fact, there are two people. There's the good one and the bad one. There's the princess and the stepmother. There is, in male tone terms, there is the prince and the giant. See? And then Bettelheim says that if this problem can be announced in a fairy tale, A, the fairy tale is not saying to the child, you're wrong, there is no trouble in your life, buck up, be happy. The fairy tale, or the parent telling stories, is saying, there is trouble in your life. We acknowledge it. We know that you suffer fully as much as we do, and we are allies in that problem. The teller of a tale sitting with the child is saying to the child, just by implication, we're together in this problem, even if I am sometimes the prince and sometimes the giant. You'll notice that all of those fairy tales, therefore, accept trouble. They don't weep to it, which is incidentally why a lot of parents say we shouldn't read that to the children. It's dangerous material. Why shouldn't you? The child is already suffering exactly that kind of thing. Bad dreams. Do you remember how bad your bad dreams were when you were young? Or how terrified you were of lightning. You don't have to tell children of evil. Children know of evil. So, yeah, read it to them. But when the fairy tale works out well, it takes several steps. One is, it usually identifies a means of overcoming that problem within the child. Very often, if you'll notice, you have three daughters or three sons, and it's the young, dumb, stupid, and ugly one who wins. And usually it's that young, dumb, stupid, and ugliness which really is only humility and gentleness and love. And the fairy tale then takes how the child sees herself and lets what the world says to be bad turn into the very means of overcoming the problem itself. But the fairy tale doesn't lie.
There is problem on the way. There is suffering on the way to overcome it. Okay? If I'm making sense, what I'm saying is when you sit down and tell, go ahead and read. Read fairy tales. Read Maurice Sendak. Read Where the Wild Things Are. Read stuff like that to them. But then when the spirit strikes you, which it ought to, for you to tell the tale yourself, and for the child therefore to see, I'm going to do this next thing for you, but for the child to see a reflection of herself in your tale, then you are together working on a problem, even if you don't know what the problem is the child has. The child may not be able to enunciate it, even to herself, okay? But the child feels it. You sit down and you're working through it. Then that, Phil, gets over that problem that you were talking about, and stories become a part of. Now, I really urge that. I really urge that, even if you feel like a stumble bum around it, make it up. The ones that my kids remember are the ones that I thought were the most rotten. When they said, this is good, I wrote it down and sent it to the publisher. The publisher said, this is bad. But my kids said it was good. So I can't judge what for them was good or bad. I just tell the story, that's all.
Some of my finest moments with my grandparents were climbing up on my grandfather's lap in the rocking chair and giving him a kiss first to get a stick of gum out of his pocket. But then listening to the stories, and I remember having my grandmother down after my grandfather had passed away. And we traveled from Spokane to Portland to Salem where I lived, and she had never been in the Columbia Gorge where she was raised until she was seven. And it got us start talking about her life and as it was when she was little, and I realized how little I knew my grandmother in terms of what her life was like when she was living what I was living. And we had about 4 or 5 days that we just talked like that, and it was so fun. And it occurs to me now, I'm going to be teaching at a preschool where that's about 6 blocks away from a really nice adult community center. And I had said to the board meeting last month, you know, that I would like to involve some of those people just coming in on a regular basis, just to be there with the kids. I'm not sure I know what's going to happen, but just to be there and interact with them. And I was just thinking, as you were saying, how nice it would be up here to, instead of maybe go to a joke night, go to a session where the older people can sit around and tell us what it's like when they were young.
That's the community. Yes, that's our community. We are one of the very few societies, the one you were talking about, who haven't had some means of sitting around the fire in long winter nights or in hot summer nights or whatever it is, and just telling stories. You remember how that went in Roots, huh? If you read Roots or you saw it, the only thing that kept that in Alex Haley's mind was sitting on the front porch of his great-grandmother's house and hearing him talk about that old African, Mandinka tribe, that hooked in there. But we don't do that so much. Yeah.
And it seems like when I think of my parents, it's like I don't think that they think about taking time to do that. You know, it seems like particularly parents who are, well, for my kids, grandparents who are still working and not having the opportunity to just really be retired grandparents, that's very difficult to stop that pace and take the time. And I think there's so many lonely older people now who've lost their family, and now with the telephone crisis the way it is, and maybe a lot of those people losing their telephones, it's going to be more and more important to spend time meeting those old people to share with us, you know, that part of
it. What an excellent thought. I hope that's on tape and that people are hearing that we should say the statement. I mean that. Excellent thought to put the elderly nursing home, or what do they call it, good place, or even Sun City, or
Retirement center.
That's it. Together with children, and some children who have no parents or single parents or whatever.
I went to my grandchild's first grade, and they had Grandmother's Day in Moses Lake, and I'd never heard of it before. And I had the time of my life until the day I got. And we first got a folder, and we had to do the work that the young ones did, and the grandchild. Told me how to do it.
Yes.
And she took me to lunch and she dished up my plate, and which was a tray, and it was just great.
Your whole
going out and play.
Generation to generation.
So it brings to mind our golden time. Mm-hmm.
Yes, that worked with that specific image.
A couple years ago, I took my grandson, who was 6 at the time, on about a 200-mile trip.
Yeah.
And I was thinking he was going to be bored, so I thought I'd tell him a few things that his father had as a child. And he was so interested. And so then I thought, well, this is getting kind of boring for me now. I'll just talk about something else. But he said, oh, Grammy, tell me more about Daddy. Tell me more. And even when he went to school, he said, so he was just so interested. And he wanted, and as soon as we got home, he ran in and told all the things I had told him.
It's like looking at your father's underpants. In our church, there was an elderly lady named Odessa who hadn't been out of lying on her back from cancer for years. So she hadn't even seen our young choir, our children's choir. It was a year ago Christmas then, or this Christmas? This last Christmas. This last Christmas, Odessa died shortly after Christmas, but the kids went around, first of all, and it was an extraordinary moment. I'm going to make again 2 points about what do we hide from the children and what should we hide. Death? I don't think so. I think they're as well able to meet these crises as anybody else, with a great deal more flexibility. God prepares us to meet such crises. We lose the preparation sometimes as we go. Went in to see Odessa lying on her back, this black lady. And the kids sang. And while they sang, she couldn't sit up. But while they sang, she directed. She directed them, and she was earnest in the direction. And those kids, at first they started singing just plain, and you could hear their hearts rise up and begin to feel their music as they sang. It wasn't just singing. She had heard of the Sounds of Grace, which is our youth choir, and it tours every year. But these were some little kids, some Sounds of Grace kids, whatever, you know, it's what you do when you go out and sing Christmas carols. And she asked for more. When they were done, and they watched her, and they were almost all in tears just from her directing and from her taking so seriously that singing, she had her eyes closed, and she said, "We are one." I can almost remember. She preached a sermon, and all the kids, some of our kids were there too. They just listened to that woman. She said, "I haven't heard you sing before, but you don't stand behind anybody," she said. And then she said, "Even though we weren't there," she preaches better than I do, "even though we haven't seen each other, we are one because we're all of grace. And we are one because we are all of God," she said, like that. And kids, like that. And I think that it was within 2 weeks she died. We brought our daughters to that funeral, because they needed to see the wholeness of Odessa's life, even unto death. And I remember that Mary cried, and then she made me almost cry. I'm the preacher, you know, we don't cry in front of Odessa. But that was the wholeness for Mary of a life, that she saw death as well, and that was part of it. And Odessa left something. Now, that wasn't exactly a story, but Odessa left something. Way in the back. Did you put your hand up?
What you were saying about young children being able to accept death and everything. When my husband passed away from cancer, and my grandson was 4 years old, and we hadn't told him yet, and the little neighbor girl was over playing with him, and she said, "Your grandpa's dead." So, of course, the daughter-in-law had to tell him. And so that night, they were sleeping in our travel trailer when they visited, and she said, "Micah," she said, "Grandpa went to heaven. God wanted him to be with him, and so he's in heaven now." And she explained all this, and she got all done. He wrapped his arms around his mother and comforted her.
Exactly. Exactly. And I watched people, when we have funeral services, the one individual that I lack most are the children. I see children from the family itself, but not from the community or from the church, when so often it is the child. And the child, I don't think, is blind to what's happening, just not devastated by what's happening.
I had quite a difficult time, I think, trying to figure out. I've never seen a young child do this. In my own children, when their father was killed, I think my youngest was 6, and I don't think he understood it as well as this child was really trying to. And I asked before this happened, my husband's son that lived with us since he was 6 had gone to stay with his mother, Kenny, and Micah thought the world of Kenny. And so one day, it was a few days after the funeral, and he said, "Grandma, Kenny's dead?" And I said, "No, Kenny's not dead. He's with his other mother," we call. And you know, he asked about so-and-so, "Are they dead?" He was trying to get this straight in his mind. Is Grandpa just gone for a while like Kenny is? Or, you know.
Yeah.
And he would, you know, every so often, little things would creep up. And you knew he was thinking about his grandpa again.
And I have to distinguish that very clear.
It's interesting how little kids are so much more straightforward. And the more we age, the more we mask things. And especially at the point of death, a small child is just, you know, it's just straight line. It's either this or this. When my mom died a couple of years ago, my daughter, 4, said, "I'm not going to see her for a long time, Ella." And I said, "No." And she said, "How about me at least 3 or 4 days?" Well, you know, for her, that was a long time. It's a very narrow perception, but they can still work that out. And as we get older, we sophisticate that. And we have ways of sort of masking that hurt and that pain and the bluntness, the realities of the hurts.
We have to sophisticate it though, and we have to, it is serious and it is complicated because we can't say all the time, "Oh, well, God called him home. God needed him now." That isn't always true. There are horrible accidents, there are horrible deaths. And it isn't easy and it isn't fair and it isn't simple. And that's why I think it gets complicated for us as we get older.
Right. Which is, by the way, though, why the children can be the comfort. Because the children, on the one hand, because they're seeing is simple, no, they don't know all the evils of it, nor do they have to know it, and yet when they say the comforting word, it's not a false word.
No.
It's a true word, because they are truly there, and they are truly whole themselves. They're beings, I mean, not all their wisdom and so forth. Oh, you're right, it isn't, and we cheat some people sometimes with our superficial clashes in the sea. That's what one fellow says. The book is in the library on Job. Royster is in there. He says that when you read Job, you know that when someone is suffering the deepest suffering of all, which is this death, you do not speak words that are superficial clashes. You simply be. You simply be with them. And then in those instances, the story is being told dramatically. It is the drama of human relations. Yes, speak on.
Changing the line of thought a little bit, I've been reflecting, as we've been talking about some of this, about the Christian church and the way it seems to me in some areas we have tended to lose our Jewish heritage, to deny that or to, you know, emphasize Christ, which we should do, but not so much Christ reinterpreting the old, but we've lost so much of the old that we're kind of in danger of losing the whole tradition in which Jesus lived and the way he thought because of what he understood. And I've been wondering how we can recapture more of that, and, you know, what avenues there are to emphasize the Jewishness, even in terms of the ecumenical thing that we've heard about too, in terms of sharing with or allowing the Jewish people to share with us their perceptions of Old Testament stories and what they meant for them.
It's a good question, and I'm only going to begin an answer. Let's all take that together. I think that's a very important question, that you're talking about the loss of a foundation when we lose that sense. I'll begin an answer, and others perhaps can begin to pick it up. First of all, I'll use the image that we used before when I talked about blessing. The elderly blessing the young. It seems to me that even in, certainly in what we call the Old Testament, what they call the Bible, and doing what we did this week, telling it as new and telling it without any taking away from, that's a start. Certainly we realize that the New Testament, as we call it, does not stand alone. It is not enough to read the Gospels or Paul or whatever. It isn't necessary to read also the Old Testament. But I would say even more for blessing. that for me, as an example, right now, Elie Wiesel, who doesn't know me, is nevertheless blessing me through the books that he has written, which I am reading now. And I feel very much like this is my grandfather talking. That there are some perceptions that Elie Wiesel has that run deeper than my perceptions can be. So that for me to begin to tip my ear in whatever way I can to the wisdom that exists now also within the Jewish culture is to be blessed by Abraham or to be blessed by Israel. Elie Wiesel is one for me.
Can
okay.
You spell that?
I hope I'm pronouncing it right. Or some say Elie Wiesel. It's E I L. No, no. It's E L I E W I E S E L. Right.
That's all one.
No, no. That's the first and second names. I'm going to get the spelling exact here. Okay. Yeah. E L I E. First name. Elie. Wiesel, W-I-E-S-E-L. He's written many books. The first book that he wrote was called Night, and it was about the Holocaust. But he's continuing. A recent book that he's written now is about the Hasidic storytellers and rabbis back into Russia. That's one way. Do you know Chaim Potok?
Yeah.
That's another way. Read Chaim Potok. Read the books this man has written. And recognize a commonality as you read those. They are fiction, and yet they are not fiction. They're based upon the kind of cultures that exist today. Here is the beginning of an answer. To recognize a commonality, a parenthood there, and to be blessed by that parenthood. Certainly to do things like, before Easter, having Seder meal. But I think that you got to go farther than that. Sometimes people sit down at confirmation in churches and they do a Seder meal and they say, isn't this neat, but this isn't us. Somehow it's got to become us. You had your hand up.
No, I was just going to mention the names of Chaim Potok's books.
The Promise,
The
Chosen.
My name is Asher Lev.
My name is Asher Lev. In the Beginning,
Book
Wanderings, Book of Lights, which is the second most recent one. That's extraordinary. There are a lot of, well, we could talk for this entire hour about Jewish writers right now, who have such a blessing to give us if you seek it. Yes?
I guess this sort of was one of my enrichments. I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood in San Francisco, so when Yom Kippur came, there were three of us left at school. I was always a minority. It was Russian and German Jews who escaped. Their parents got out before Hitler got to them. And in our own church, our church that I grew up in was across the street from Temple Emmanuel. And we, before the kids took their bar mitzvah and bar mitzvah, it was a Reformed Jewish church. They would always come over to our worship services. We went to the Purim festivals to, if our friends took their bar mitzvahs, then we were invited to there. And it was a very close relationship. The cantor of the Temple Emmanuel had gone to Reed College with our pastor. And, you know, they were classmates. And when we remodeled our church, they gave gifts. And it was a really neat Jewish heritage that I just took for granted and figured out of the way the rest of the world went. But, I've never thought of myself, I've always thought of my faith starting with Abraham and coming through, and, you know, not just starting with the New Testament.
That's good. I would make a suggestion, if you have opportunity to establish relationships like this, or with Jews that may be living near you, or the authors and so forth and so on, that you do with grave respect and watchfulness. Sometimes Christians, when it finally dawned on them that they ought to establish a relationship, you know, the Jews come with such arrogance. It's almost like the American saying, okay, here I am coming to another culture and everyone should be so happy to receive me. It doesn't work that way. And sometimes what we conceive to be the religion of another people is simply us taking our Christian religion, changing the words around and thinking that we can understand. When we're coming into something which is cultural and so vastly different cultural that you have to go like clay, ready to be stamped with wide open ears and with much humility. I mean, with honest humility. But that's the beginning of an answer on the preservation of that. You're right. Thank you.
Yes. I don't want to change the subject, but there is something that concerns me very much. I grew up during a period of time where I witnessed the progressive depersonalization, and this fits right into the disappearance of storytelling, the lack of communication between the older and the younger generations, and especially between grandparents and children growing up, who in this technological age were unable to find common ground. And I grew up during a period of storytelling where I cherish this heritage. At the same time, in one of your lectures, you mentioned the in connection with epics, that we do not have in these times heroes and men we can look up to. Now, storytelling may involve personal history. Grandfather can tell what it was like in his time, two generations ago. The father can tell his children. Development is so fast that one generation probably is equivalent to at least 50 years ago. And at the same time, there is also storytelling of heroes of the past, whether it is the Bible or whether it's the history of pagans and from other people. Now, the absence of this personal involvement, I do not believe that we do not have people here anymore who are active in social and political events and who accomplish enormous feats that we can look up to. I believe the lack of storytelling contributes that we do not get the concept anymore that we do have heroes here at this time. I pose this as a question. Is this a conclusion?
Oh, I was agreeing with you all the way through. I thought you were proposing it as a statement. And a good one, I think, yes. What does storytelling, when we tell of heroes or of people whom we have heard of, makes it come with flesh and blood on it. It has, that's when I talked at the very beginning about my father telling stories, I remember the smell of that. I remember the feel and the warmth of my father's body. I remember the sheets that we were lying on the bed, all of which puts a wholeness of reality to it. When we read about somebody in the newspaper and it's print and it's ink, we shut all of our senses off, and then you're right, we receive this not in a way that we could receive it with adoration. One of the things that C.S. Lewis says epic did for him was to remind him how to adore. That he was not born, or he was not trained with the ability, literally, of adoring the divine, of giving it blessing, of praising it, of giving it thanks. Epic, when it came to him, specifically, first of all, the northern epics, the northernness, made him begin to look at nature in a new way, that it participated somehow or other in the supernatural, so that then he began to look at nature with adoration, with praise, and with thanksgiving, as though somehow or other the divine were on the other side of it. When we receive our stories through a box, television, which can get us a great deal of information, we are the informational age, we receive it intellectually, and we store it as best as we can intellectually, but we do not adore that information. When we receive it from people who are talking, then it draws upon this vast human capacity which we have, which we are otherwise not called upon to use, which is praise and thanksgiving and adoration, and then we do it in terms of tears and laughter. And laughter, my belly goes, you know, it actually moves, and but my heart is going at the same time, and I'm saying stupid little things like, did I say that? You know, yes, I'm saying yes to you. The lack of storytelling is one of the reasons why these people are not adored, or we don't meet them with kind of a devotion at the same time. I think you are very right. I hope we can move back that.
Very interesting, in the Hindu and the Buddhist faith, these two great religions of Asia, they are, everything comes from their epics and their stories and their heroes. We from our Christian culture in the West, we look at that and we say, go look at all the gods that they're worshipping. And they are not gods at all, and they are not idols, but they are all people with a story. And many of them myths, stories, but all of them with meaning. And as those stories were retold again and again, people then worshipped and thanked and praised.
And adored. Let me make a suggestion as it occurs to me, that we be like those peoples. I found about 8 years ago, on Easter Sunday morning, none of the Sunday school teachers showed up. It was first year I was at Grace, and that turned out to be a tradition I didn't know about. But the children showed up. And so there I was with all these children and no teachers, and in a sort of a fit of wondering, what am I going to do now with all these children sitting around? I simply told them the story. I told them the story from Palm Sunday, from the entrance into Jerusalem, all the way through Thursday night. And I told it to them from an emotional viewpoint. You know, I'm not teaching even, writing on the blackboard. I said, this is how they felt. I said, you know, this, you remember it coming in, Jesus weeps over Jerusalem. Oh, that'll blow a kid away. See how, and then you have this conflict between Judas and what Judas is doing, and you can set that kind of a thing up with how Jesus might feel about being betrayed, especially the feelings. And I was surprised that I had never thought of such a thing before, so simple. And that was what I did, that I just told the story all the way through to the end. And the children were like this. I would say to you, as you have a chance in your parishes or in your homes or whatever, sometime, just plain old, tell the story. Don't put a book between you. If you can get away from that, don't. And don't worry if you mess it up a little bit for not having the book. But touch, for the children, touch the feeling. For heaven's sakes, for all the people, touch the feelings. You know, say how Jesus must have felt. And it's there, you know. Mom, my heart is sore troubled, and what will I say? Get me out of this hour? No, I'll say, glorify me. Or, you know, as he walks to Gethsemane. How can you not do this? Just talk what you're saying, but let your body begin to talk, and here come all the smells and everything, as you're going to Gethsemane, and he's going, and his disciples are there, and he crosses the Brook Kidron. How tired he must have been by the time he got there and said, wait. And imagine how he must have felt when he went and he prayed, and it wasn't like this from the picture. You know, it was, ah! And he prayed, and then he gets up and he goes to the disciples, and they're sleeping. Couldn't you wait with me 1 hour? All that you can do with that kind of emotions at that time, when people begin to swallow because they feel like they're Peter, James, and John. They know why I went to sleep. I just suggest that to you, and don't worry about, do you have skills at storytelling? People, if you are committed to two things, if you are committed to touching the people to whom you were talking, if you're committed to them, number one. And number two, if you're committed to the thing that you have to say, if it is important to you to get that thing that you have to say into those ears, you will be an extraordinary storyteller, even if you stutter from the beginning to the end. Because that will communicate itself. This is important. Did you see a movie long, long ago? I don't think he's a particularly good actor. I shouldn't say things like those. It was a Jackie Gleason. It was back in the 50s, I believe, because I was still in high school, and it was a one name. I wish I could remember the name of it, but Jackie Gleason played a deaf mute.
Godot?
What? No, that sounds close.
Godot,
what?
Godot or?
Something like that. Something like that. He played a deaf mute, and he was with it. Was it a little girl?
Uh-huh.
That's right. And he wanted to tell her about his religion and his faith. And he took her into a cathedral, as I recall, and he couldn't do it. And this is a very simple movie, but I remember this scene more than anything else, where he took her up to the chancel, and he stood in the chancel, and with his inability to speak, he pointed at things and tried to get her to understand. So he pointed at a crucifix like that, and it was like she wasn't understanding. And the only noise that they had at that point was a trumpet. It was a trumpet, which is like undifferentiated, undefined emotion. And he went like that, and the trumpet went, and so, but the girl didn't understand, but I did. He wasn't even talking, and I understood. That's what I'm trying to tell you. You can tell stories if, number one, you are committed to getting this kind, you can do deaf mute. You can tell stories if this thing is so important to get across. Incidentally, this is what I tell preachers in homiletics, not from my knees. In school, I'm a professor. But if you want to get it across, and then you want to get it across to them, to those people that are in front of you, you can tell a story. So my first point, too, is when you have that opportunity to tell it, just tell it as a story. Just tell it as a story. The second thing, suggestion, in parishes once again, we've done this and it works remarkably. On Passion Sunday, act it. Let the whole congregation act it. This last year we took it according to Luke, because that was the cycle that we were in, Series C. And all I did was take the Lucan account of the Passion and write it out, except I let the congregation be different parts of it. Okay? And they began, first of all, by being something that was unthreatening. They just simply began by being the people who were readying Jesus into Jerusalem. And then they were the disciples for a little while. But bit by bit, they got to be what we often really are. They got to be the people that were crying for a crucifixion. And we had a drum. Just a little bit of emotion there, just a drum. All it did, it began very quiet. Boom. 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 But as we got closer and closer to the crowd being in front of Pontius Pilate, that drum was going boom, 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 and it was urging them on until finally when they crowded out, crucify us, crucify. Wow, those people, they're surprised that they could feel that way. You know, to call for a crucifixion of somebody else like that. And when the death came, when the death scene, that drum stopped. And that silence spoke. It's not difficult to do that. It doesn't take a whole lot of skill. Just, you know, you can put it, and then maybe you have some readers for the various parts. So that the story be a story. Well, we need to do it that way now. Who's telling it? They are! They're in the middle of it. They're telling it. Bring them out the other end, if you please.
When I first came to the parish I was serving, it was my tradition to do children's sermons, and we had maybe two kids. One of them was ours. It would come up for a children's sermon. That was the sum total of the kids available. A lot of times it was just our daughter there, and so instead I just have her sit down in the congregation, come down and mix the congregation and do the children's sermon with the whole group. And it was just amazing to watch them get into that. You get up in the pulpit and start delivering the adult sermon, and there's just, you know, just sort of full blasé about what's going on. But the children's sermon, doing it in the midst of the people.
Right.
It doesn't need to be kids.
Maybe by the time you're done, the children's sermon takes 20 minutes, adult, you can do it too.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. And they really get into it. And I again, it goes back to that thing of storytelling.
Sure.
When you tell the story, and you just let it be, instead of having a manuscript and all the exegetical study and that sort of crap, you know, you don't need that.
And you can do it. That's the point I keep trying to say. Don't mimic somebody else. When you have those earnest desires to get this thought into those ears, do it your own way. To be honest with yourself, period. And people are listening.
It's also very amazing how effective a children's story is for the adults.
Yes.
Yeah. You listen.
We listen much better.
All kinds of thoughts keep running through my mind, but I have to tell about one thing. I used to tell my hyperactive grandson that I would take 170 miles north from his home to my home, stories all the way, because it was the only way I could keep him quiet, and he would listen. And I'd tell stories about the people that I thought lived in the houses as we went along. And after a while, he wanted the same story. And you know, I never knew what I was saying. And I'll never forget the time that he was angry half of the way home because I told the wrong story.
He had it, yes.
Seems to me this might be an indication for what you said, that we should maybe think in terms of getting rid of the pulpit.
That's right.
And causing a week from the longer congregation in Seattle and Renton, where Charlie Mays is the pastor, and he never uses the pulpit, and he never has notes or books or anything to get in between him and the people.
I can always tell when I'm into the text, because if I'm not into the text, I'd rather have the pulpit, that way I can hide behind it.
Yeah.
Separation. So I start throwing the tomatoes, I have something to duck behind.
Listen, the word of God comes by all that you have to communicate. When I was young and being raised up, we were told, I don't know how y'all feel about this, but we were told that the pastor wore robes to hide the pastor's physique and identity and person so that it only be Jesus Christ that stand forth. I bought into it for a while, and now I think, but how is Jesus Christ going to stand forth? Just from the words? The word is a living thing, and the instrument that communicates that living thing is this thing. Walter Wandren, this thing communicates, which is why I am where you are. No, I don't use the pulpit. It began to be restrictive, and it began to ask them only to hear. Now this, but I, you know, you'd be careful, because that's a real step to take sometimes. To hear only in terms of the intellectual. Now that's not, finally you want to begin to understand it is not a proud thing to say, look at me while I preach. Let me touch you while I preach. That's not a proud thing, it's a very humbling thing, because it says the Lord is willing even to use these arms, this facial expression, these eyes, this body, to carry that living word across.
Well, as you said, it's a living word, and our earliest communication, before we understand words, is this looming face over the cliff, and the touch, and you know, you can talk to a child without saying a word. I mean, I do it on the U-Bahn in West Berlin sometimes when their parents aren't watching, you know, especially up to the age of one years old. You know, there's joy that can be conveyed, and sorrow, and laughter, and I think it's so essential, you know.
Yes.
Communication is, you may as well be listening to the radio, right?
Yeah. I second what you said, very much, and what you said. Well, that bell is calling us to something. One more thought.
I think I have something to tell that we all know the importance of very little things. Sometimes the importance of just being present with something. I had experience this summer that was very, to me, was a blessing. One of the Bible school teachers had asked me if I was dressed up as the prophetess Anna and come to her second grade class. She thought that would be neat. That was one of the stories that they had. And I said, oh, sure, I'll do that. I went down to the church the first morning that they had Bible school, and the teachers came, of course, for their meeting, pre-meeting, and some of them had small children. So one of the girls asked me, well, would you just sort of watch these children until the teachers come out and they're taking them out to a home? So I said, oh yes, I'll watch these children. And so I ended up, one of the teachers had a two-month-old baby that had just been baptized in church the Sunday before. And I'm watching that baby, and that was a real privilege. Take care of this child. I ended up doing that for the whole 5 days. And they had Sunday school, I would take care of this baby, and I would just be around there as a grandmother. And when I took this child to when I visited different classes to tell the story of Anna, I was the prophetess Anna. I had been in the temple when the Lord Jesus did to be dedicated. And I fudged a little bit. I said, I lived in that temple, and I saw the baby Jesus. I even asked his mother if I could hold the baby Jesus. In a sense, we all hold baby Jesus. And then I went on to tell the story. This baby Matthew is Judas the Lead in London. I said, he was brought to the Lord. He was made a child of God in baptism last Sunday, just as you have been. And so then the evening that they had, Friday evening, when they had their program, I had dressed up as a long brown robe as the prophetess Anna might have looked. And at the end of the program, they said, well, we have had a visitor from afar. And so I had to get up again and tell this little, simple story of the joy of seeing the baby Jesus. And for me, it was the most tremendous experience in the world. That I felt a unity with all the children. Matter of fact, what did Imani do? I just acquired 160 grandchildren.
You are good talkers. Thank you.